This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and publishing. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I have the great pleasure of talking to Nicholas Caneos about his publishing as Arte Publico Press, and before that, America's Review, and even going before that, you've been publishing for a long time, Nicholas.
Yeah, I guess since around 72.
So I guess, why don't we start from the very beginning and tell me, you know, what were you doing at that time and what prompted you to start publishing the magazine, which really is how this all began, I think, was with a literary magazine called Revista Chiquenia.
Yeah, I was involved very heavily in the Latino civil rights movement, both in Texas and in the Midwest, and during the late 60s and early 70s. And it, part of that was working with a theater group. I belonged to the Teatro Chicano de Austin in Austin, Texas, and then later I founded my own group up in Gary, Indiana, that performed all around the Midwest. And throughout the movement, artists and writers were everywhere, and they didn't have any place to publish. There were just very, very few outlets publishing Mexican-Americans, Puerto Ricans, or any Latinos at all. And so I founded with a partner, Luis Davila, Revista Chicano-Riqueña in 1972. We actually got our first number out early in 73. And it was basically a place for Latinos from coast to coast to get their works published and circulated. But first of all, since we were located in academia, both of us were scholars at Indiana University. I had recently gotten my PhD at the University of Texas. And we explored and were able to, I'd say, manage quite well the means of distribution and marketing through academia. So we became pretty well known in academic circles and also out on the field at Hispanic festivals, civil rights movement. We would be selling the magazine wherever people were getting together to protest, do marches, or have literary artistic festivals. And during those years, I traveled quite a bit to all of these venues and was promoting the magazine from coast to coast at these conferences and festivals and what have you. So that's basically how it started. And it was an effort of scholars and students and people in the community as well.
So, and you were coming, you were doing a quarterly at that point, which is, I mean, that's a fair,
that's right,
fairly large amount of work, and you were doing this at the same time as you were carrying a full load of teaching, is that right?
Yeah, I was teaching, I was also directing the theater company, and I was also getting training from the Saul Alinsky School of Community Organizing and working with community groups, pushing for, you know, hiring firemen and policemen and teachers and counselors and pushing for bilingual education. So, but I, you know, back then I saw it all as one effort.
Right. Well, and a lot, I think that was fairly common in that period. I think a lot of the literary magazines and independent publishers did come from this kind of cultural period of cultural revolutionary work, in some ways. And, you know, it's, I think that's maybe something that we don't see as often anymore, but, so were you, I guess what I wanted to ask is, when you first started, did you know anything about printing and, typesetting and book layout and, or, type layout and how to produce the magazine, or did you have to learn that as you went?
No, we had to learn from scratch. Of course, you know, we were familiar with magazines and books and journals. We had, and I guess some of the earlier issues of the magazine really looked like a scholarly journal, even though it was published in creative writing. you know, book reviews and some scholarly articles on to promote Latino literature. So those were our models. We also had some good breaks, you know. Like one of my professors in graduate school, when we started the magazine, was the president of the American Association of Teachers of Spanish and Portuguese, which is the largest group of professors and teachers dedicated to the Spanish language. And they published a magazine that still exists. It has been published for over 100 years, called Hispania. And it has 60,000 subscribers. And he gave me free advertising in that. And thanks to that, the first 500 subscriptions came in. So I didn't know all that much about marketing. What I did know about, what I did bring to the founding of the magazine was having worked for many years in high school and college as a shipping clerk in New York City and in Jersey, shipping things like women's hats. I worked in the garment district, or shower curtains. So I knew all about the different classes of mail. I knew about, you know, all of the rules and regulations. You had to know them back then because it was very complex. There was no FedEx. There was no UPS, etc. So you had to know about shipping in bulk. You had to know about sorting mail. You know, had to know about the various classes of mail to sort. And basically, I knew the business end. I knew how to get things out the door and charge and send out invoices and all that kind of stuff, which a lot of people who start magazines don't know about that. All they think about is the literary, the cultural, the artistic, and they don't have a grasp of what it actually means to sell a product and get it out to people across a wide geographic range. So I knew that because I worked at it for years.
I think that's really, actually is very important. I'm glad you brought that up, because I think it's true that many, not just magazines, but any all kinds of artistic organizations who don't have those kinds of skills and sometimes fail to recognize their importance, sometimes don't last. So you did this magazine for 25 years. And it changed. Now it changed its name to the America's Review. What was the purpose of the name change? I assume that signified something at that time.
Yeah, it signified we got a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts to get a consultant, and he, to increase our marketing ability, he greatly advised, recommended that we change the name so it would be understandable to librarians and other people.
Did you agree with, did you think that was good advice?
I thought it was, well, we changed it. We thought it was good advice, but actually a lot of our subscribers didn't. They thought, you know, we had watered down, we had sold out to the mainstream, you know, all kinds of stuff like that.
Right, right. So, what was the reason that you decided to stop publishing after 25 years, the magazine?
Sure. That's because in 1979, we founded Arte Público Press. And we discovered that it's a lot easier to publish a book than to keep a magazine going, which is maintaining a whole community,
right,
of thought and correspondence, you know, just really mailing stuff back and forth, begging reviewers to do their job, getting the reviews in, getting, you know, it's just like it's a constant work, not to mention getting people to renew their subscriptions and everything else. So on the one hand, that was wearing on us since the early 80s. On the other hand, and as we published more books, it became quite evident that the effort and the investment in publishing a magazine versus publishing books was diminishing as far as what could happen with the magazine. But then, you know, we kept having, you know, trying to make it work. At one point, we had 5,000 subscriptions, and during the 80s, as we published more books, the subscriptions fell. And my analysis of why the subscriptions fell and why we eventually we closed the magazine was that during the 70s and early 80s, our magazine was being used as textbook in lots of university classes. But once books were available, they preferred to have books than actual numbers of a magazine to be studying in class and, you know, using them for whatever, those or as anthologies, what have you. And in the magazine, we did publish on occasion anthological issues, you know. So after 25 years, we decided to call it a day. And we closed the magazine. Believe it or not, we had still had 500 subscriptions.
Do you ever miss publishing a magazine? I don't know whether that's a meaningful question, but I'm kind of curious.
No, don't miss it. Don't miss it at all.
That's good. So no sentimental connection to that former entity.
No.
So then there's this Coral. Go ahead.
I do have sentimental connections. I mean, all the work that we put in and the writers that we launched through the magazine, I mean, it's virtual who's who of Latino literature in the United States. But it had run its course. And so I'll always look fondly upon it and be proud of what it achieved. But we had to close it down, and we invested all of our energy in Arte Público Press.
So let's talk about the press, because that's a perfect lead in. I think you started the press in 1979. What was the impulse at that point? Was it because through doing the magazine you had identified these writers and you felt that you needed to give them a larger platform?
That's one of the reasons. But first of all, we had to know that we could do it business wise. So what we were learning was when we did special thematic issues of the magazine that turned out to be the size of a book, and people were buying them for their classes and using them as textbooks and what have you, we realized that we could just as well publish a book. And in fact, what we did in the course of the years was we took some of those thematic issues and we registered them as ISBN and got them out as book as well. So they had ISSN and an ISBN number. So that proved to us that we could publish books. Then a couple of the standby publishing houses of Latino literature, which were never big, but they were well-known in the community, went under. And so there was we picked up the torch and carried it forward. So that's number two. But number three is we had worked with all these writers, and it was time for them to have books. So that's what we did. We got the first, let's say, 10, 12 books out with writers that we had published in the magazine, and some writers who we had published in the magazine but who had books with those presses. Quinto Sol Publishing out of Berkeley is one in particular that went under, and we inherited some of their very important writers. And we're still publishing them to this day. So that was it, expanding the range for these writers. And also what we wanted to do, and we did this right from the get-go, was the women writers that had been working with us in the Revista Chicano Riqueña, the America's Review, we tapped them to get books out, because during the Chicano movement, during the Latino civil rights movement, women had been pretty much in, let's say, de-emphasized by the males. And it was a very, if we can say, phallocentric movement. And
yeah, I think that's accurate to say.
So among the first books that we got out through Arte Público Press were books by Lona de Cervantes, Sandra Cisneros, Pat Moore, Evangelina Vigil, Denise Chavez, and so on and so forth. And we just kept publishing. And at one point, we started doing a marketing campaign that the reins of Latino literature in the hands of women. And then we would list them and promote their books. And then we would take them on tour, which is one thing that we did always from the beginning with Arte Público was do author tours. but it's not the kind of author tours to bookstores, because bookstores didn't know we existed. They were to community centers and festivals and to universities. Again, our strong suit was the whole academic market. So we'd raise money and send authors around and make them available to universities, knowing that the universities would also start using their books as texts.
Right. No, I think that was very smart. And is that something that you still can do today? Because, you know, for most, many book publishers, the whole idea of author tours has changed. But it sounds like for you, because of the academic connection and also the connection to communities, that that may be less of a problem, that you could still do author tours today.
Right. We're still doing it. In fact, the last couple of weeks, we had four events. We took three authors to Fort Bend County Library. We had a Dia, what the heck was it called? Dia del Libro on the plaza of the public Central Public Library in Houston. And our marketing department works with universities, professors, with the associations, you know, like the National Association of Teachers of English, you know, all of those associations, with the Library Association. And we're there lobbying to get our writers into panels and into performances at those conferences. And we try to book, block book, by also having them go off into the community and doing things or going with schools. We have very strong programs to tour writers to schools. So yeah, we're still doing it, and occasionally we do bookstores. But bookstores, unlike the big commercial industry, bookstores are not our primary market for touring.
Right. Now, what about for sales? Do you find that you know, many independent publishers have seen, over the last 20 years or maybe even longer, as independent bookstores have declined in number, that has affected the number of stores that they're able to do business with, or, you know, with Borders going out of business and maybe Barnes & Noble doing less with books and more with other kinds of products. Has that affected you less because you've relied on stores less than other publishers?
Yes, that's right. It's affected us less, although we have been sensitive to having fewer opportunities to take writers to the bookstores. But there are specialized bookstores, independent bookstores, that we still work with. Like, we just had a writer at Murder by the Book here in Houston, which is a mystery bookstore. We've been publishing this noir writer, Manuel Ramos, who's done very well. Last year, he won the Colorado Book Award. So he's got quite a following, and we still go to bookstores, but when, you know, just as I said, with Manuel, we took him to that bookstore, but we also had him at a university, and we had him out on the library plaza at our event. So it was like triple shot for him.
No, that's good. So, and for you, has the rise of Amazon been a good thing in terms of book sales?
Yeah, we do very well with Amazon. And, you know, they keep changing about their regs and what you got to do, and it's a pain in the neck, but still, it's a very, very good stream for us, as well as for our ebooks.
And do you sell direct? I looked on your website, it looks like you sell directly to bookstores and libraries. Of course, you also use wholesalers, but does that mean for Amazon, you ship books to them directly?
Yes, we do.
That is a lot of work.
Yeah.
And so yeah. Do you have, I mean, just physically, you know, do you have a kind of miniature warehouse space? Is this all housed at the University of Houston?
We have a very large warehouse. We have about $2 million worth of stock in the warehouse at any one time.
That's a big warehouse.
Yeah.
And is all that at the university?
Yes. We have a small building at the university and a large warehouse. It's all ours.
And is the staffing yours, or does that go through university hiring? And, you know, the people that work for you, I assume, are employees of the university, but you handle the whole business yourself?
yeah, we do all the hiring and et cetera, but the benefit of being in the university is that they take care of all the overhead and use university systems for payroll, for benefits, you know, for insurance, for all kinds of stuff. Janitorial. We don't have to worry about any of that. The university takes care of it.
Right. That's really good.
we have a lot of square footage. So, I mean, it's at least, you know, it could be as much. I haven't totaled it up. Could be as much as a million in kind a year, you know.
So I have.
But we're an official. We built it into the university as an official university program. So we also get, you know, we get some undergrad and grad students to work with us that we don't have to pay.
But and they get to learn how things work.
You bet.
So they're
like interns.
Right. That seems, I think beneficial for everyone. You're essentially, able to train another wave of potential literary publishers.
Yeah, that's right.
So, I mean, just out of curiosity, how big is your warehouse?
They're paid. They're either paid by the government through the work-study program or they're paid through the university as graduate research assistants.
Right. No, that's really good. I think that's an important component of having a press or a magazine located at a university. You get to, you get staff, but you also are training at the same time.
Right.
So, how many books do you now publish every year of all the different kinds that you do?
Right. Yeah, we do a total of about 25 a year.
That's for anybody who knows, that's a lot of books. That's how much work that is. But you now also, aside from the literary books and the drama books that you were doing, you've also added in recent years a line of children's books for different ages. And maybe you could talk a little bit about what drove you, or, what kind of pushed you into doing children's books.
Well, there's a tremendous need, number one. Number two, we realized that we had to grow our readers so that it couldn't, people had to get used to reading about Latinos from the get-go, like from preschool all the way through school, what have you. And basically that was it, a very great need. And everything that we do on the children's, we have three divisions in our children's and young adult publishing. We have bilingual children's picture books. We have bilingual middle readers, what teachers call chapter books. And we have young adult books. Now, the young adult books, many of them are in English, but some of them we do two editions, an English and a Spanish edition, or we do a bilingual edition. But all the other levels are completely bilingual, and they're all based on Latino culture in the United States. Nothing is imported. It's about life here, and we don't really do, animal stories and things like that. We basically, it's about seeing yourself in this environment and seeing yourself on the pages of a book and promoting literacy. But the number one thing that we're concerned with at every single level is that this is literary art. It's not pedagogical.
Right. It's storytelling. I mean, you're trying to be entertaining at the same time.
Right. And we have worked with some and helped the conversion of some adult writers like Judith Ortiz Colfer into writing for the children's and young adults. And so the artistic merit is very high on these books, and they've won a lot of awards. And they've been very, very successful. To speak frankly, they sell more than the adult books. But that's understandable, because given the need.
Well, yes, and in fact, it struck me that, there's always conversation now every year in commercial children's book publishing about the lack of diversity. And the fact that they out of, I think, I can't remember the exact number, but out of 5,000 books published, you know, the number of non-white protagonists was minuscule. I mean, really, truly a small number. It was shocking. So the need is very large. And I would assume that you get a lot of support from teachers and librarians.
Yes, we do. But of course, you know, the marketing is still a very, very rough row to hoe, because there are giants out there that suck up all the air, you know, like Scholastic. And Scholastic actually buys from us and rebrands some of our material as theirs. Just, you know, making, you know, Scholastic gives out these their pulp paper catalogs at virtually every classroom in the country. And then they run book fairs in virtually every public school in the country. You know, so to compete with that is very difficult. What gets me about the discussions in commercial publishing about the lack of diversity is when they start coming up with some solution, they never think about us. They never think about the people who are actually publishing the diverse material and how to get it. You know, it's always about, you know, hiring a minority editor or something.
Yeah, I actually am surprised. And I was going to ask you if in that context you'd ever been contacted by a publisher, because you have a bank of titles, you have an ongoing program. It would seem to make sense for a publisher who wants to, and plus you have a market, you know, people know who you are, the readers are aware of you. It's just, it would seem like a natural thing for someone to reach out to you and say, let's collaborate.
Yeah. Well, what we are doing and where our material is in demand is through subsidiary sales, which takes the form of everything from Scholastic taking one of our children's picture books and buying the rights to it or publishing it as a paperback or whatever, or these very, very large textbook companies incorporating our books into their textbooks, or all the online publishers that are supplying material for schools using our material, you know, like as much as a million end users at a time, which, you know, never thought about in the past. And just even, you know, how do you charge them for that, right?
Yeah. No, that's complicated because, you know, it may be a lot of people, but they have to charge kind of micro amounts of money per reader.
Right.
And do you also do foreign rights and sell the rights to your books to other countries?
Yes, we do. Yeah. We're in Hindi or in Chinese or in Japanese, Croatian, Serbian, you know, Danish.
And not that
we've sold, you know, tons, but, you know, we sell some. Years ago, I used to go to Frankfurt, and I haven't gone in ages. We have some agents in China and in Europe, and the European agents represent us at Frankfurt. I'm sure that if I went, or one of our people went, we could do a lot more sales, but it's such an effort and so costly.
It's very expensive. Well, but I mean, this may be just a naive question to ask, but is it possible for you to sell books in Spanish or bilingual Spanish and English books in other native Spanish speaking countries or markets like Mexico and South America and Spain? Is that possible, or is that not something that happens?
It's very hard to get books across the borders despite free trade agreements. That's number one. What we have sold abroad is either through translation, or if it's like, for instance, if it's a bilingual kids book or something, or a writer who writes bilingually, we can license the rights. We've licensed the rights in Spanish, but not English.
Right.
So they'll go ahead and just use the Spanish, which is fine with us.
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
You know, like you remember Tato Laviera, now deceased Tato Laviera, poet from New Rican poet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they came out with a Tato Laviera anthology collection in Buenos Aires. But they had to skim, you know, had to go through all of his books and just pick out the Spanish poems. You know. And so that's the way he did it.
Oh, interesting. So, yeah. And you mentioned ebooks. I take it that all of your books are, as you do, all the new books are digitized. Have you gone back and made your backlist digital as well?
Yeah, we're almost complete with making the complete, like, 600 titles converted into ebooks.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
I think sometimes people underestimate how much work it is to convert, you know, books that were produced prior to there being digital production methods.
Right. Yeah. Even the new books, you know, the whole industry, or let me say not the industry, agents think that publishers are saving a lot of money by producing ebooks and selling ebooks. But the truth is that it takes almost the same effort, because there are about 30 distributors and wholesalers of ebooks out there, and every single one of them has specific requirements for metadata and everything. So you need to have pay people, hire, you know, part of your staff has to be dedicated to filling out every single book that you publish, like 30 different ebook, 30 different formats for them, besides just the regular conversion, you know, and everything else that goes into making an ebook. And then the problem with ebooks is they're so hard to market. The whole industry really doesn't know how to market ebooks, so they still depend on the print marketing to get a book known.
That's true. Well, the other cost is the sort of downstream cost that I think is neglected, and that is that when you sell ebooks and all those different platforms you're talking about, each of them reports sales in a different schedule and a different form. So you have to collect all that sales information for your royalty reporting system, and each one of those efforts has, you know, there's work that goes into those.
Absolutely. So, I mean, they've really overestimated the value of getting rid of paper and shipping.
Well, and it actually, because it's not going away, print is not going to be replaced by digital. So, ultimately, you're maintaining two infrastructures.
That's right.
So, yeah, maybe, and there is some savings. There's no question on ebooks where you don't have to warehouse, you don't have to reprint, you don't have to pack and ship. You know, there's no question it saves you some money, but it's probably, as you say, and I'm sure that many publishers have calculated this, but, you know, maybe, you know, the savings are in percentage points, not in huge amounts of money.
And, you know, and the Authors Guild wants 40%. Some other organizations of writers want 50% royalties for the writers. That's really hard to do.
Yeah, I would think. So maybe you should talk a little bit about the Recovery Project, because that's been a really big endeavor on your part going back now more than 20 years. And I assume that is still a critical component of your undertaking.
Oh, yeah. It'll have its 25th anniversary in 2016.
So maybe just talk a little bit about how that started and what you do. What does that really mean every year for you in terms of work?
Right. Recovering U.S. Hispanic Literary Heritage actually is a program to find, preserve, digitize, and make available all of the written culture that Latinos have created in the United States from the colonial period, that is, before the U.S. even existed in this territory that became the U.S., up till 1960. In other words, when we started the poem, we just thought about literature, but it quickly grew into any kind of written culture, from correspondence to manuscripts to diaries, pharmacy books, cookbooks, anything. So it's a massive undertaking that we work with maybe, you know, more. Well, we have about 5,000 affiliate scholars around the world, actually. And it's it empowers scholars and librarians and archivists to look for this material. And we centralize it over here, and we work with it to, if it's on paper, we try to preserve it through microfilm and or digitization and eventually make it available in large databases of hundreds of thousands of texts. Now, we're working, after we get all this material and we process it, we work with the world's largest database publisher, that's EBSCO, Inc., and they make it available to subscribers around the world. And principally, the subscribers are academic libraries and some very few public libraries. So it's a very, very, what should I say, elite kind of publishing that goes really to students and scholars every place. And it's our main emphasis is electronic publishing through EBSCO, and we also made something like 440 newspapers available that we collected, complete runs or the runs that exist, through another company called Newsbank. And so they make the newspapers available, and all of this material is completely accessible through access on the internet. You can email the material, you can download it, you can print it. You can put notes on it. You can do all kinds of things and manipulate the database when you're using it for your purposes of research and writing papers or what have you. We also do print publishing, and we've published some 40 books out of it, of the kinds of things that can be rescued, that can be recovered, like the first anthology of exile literature published in New York, of Latino exile literature published in New York in 1856, or a novel by one of the first writers of kind of indigenous novels in the Hispanic culture of the United States called Hico Tenkal, published in 1825 in New York. The first novels of immigration, for instance, published, the first one that we found so far is 1914, published by a Colombian in New York. Now, it sounds like New York is overrepresented. Actually, as you get into the 20th century, the Southwest really comes strong in the kinds of materials that were being written and published and what have you. And we have conferences every 2 years where the scholars come together to discuss this whole, what they're doing, their methodologies, that what they have found, so on and so forth. And we, up until a few years ago, we were able to get foundation support for giving scholarships or fellowships to scholars to do research for the project during their summers off. There's just a lot of different things that we're doing with the project, and it keeps going. We collect royalties, considerable royalties, from these database publishers. In fact, we have a very good agreement with EBSCO where they even help us finance some of the research that we conduct, and it's not chargeable against the royalties. So in a thumbnail, basically that's what we're doing.
No, it sounds really good.
Yeah, we publish anthologies out of the material. We publish, we do special conferences instead of just a general conference. We might have a conference on recovering the linguistic heritage of the Hispanic linguistic heritage of the United States, which, by the way, we published in print and ebook. And believe it or not, that's our best-selling ebook. It sold over 1,200 ebook copies, which I couldn't even believe. You know, that's such a topic that's specialized, you know, and we've partnered with Oxford University Press to do the first comprehensive anthology of Hispanic literature in the United States. We publish an anthology, anthologies in Spanish of the material, so It's been very rich.
No, it sounds great. I'm actually curious, the novel that you mentioned by the Columbian in 1914, was that published in the United States in English or in Spanish?
In Spanish.
Got it. And so
up until World War II, most of the material's in Spanish. And that not what we do in some cases like that is we commission a translation.
Right.
So we have the Spanish original edition of that novel, and we published the English translation as well.
Right. No, I think that's fantastic. That is really important work, too. And then I guess the last thing that I noticed you've started to do is a fairly new program called Salud Familia.
Oh, yeah.
And that looks like a whole other direction for you. Maybe you could talk about that. It's a health and nutrition education program.
Yes. That actually grew out of our children's bilingual picture book publishing. And what it is that we convened a board of distinguished nutritionists, public health scholars, doctors from coast to coast, like the head of the director of public health for Yale University and his opposite number at Berkeley, et cetera. And we set up this board and to give us guidelines and tell us how to address the plague of obesity among Hispanic children. Of any culture in the United States, Hispanic children and the Hispanic community is the most obese and therefore suffers the highest degree of diabetes. And so we wanted to address the health issues at the root in the family and in kids. So what we did was we brought writers together with these scholars and practitioners and got the issues really, down to basics. And we commissioned writers to competitively to submit to us children's bilingual picture books that would entertain kids while giving them these messages about healthy eating, about exercise, about the good foods, that kind of stuff. And what we did with that was when we published those books, we worked with 120 health agencies around the country to distribute them for free. And many of the ways that they distributed them was through what they call promotoras, community health workers, who are actually the people who live in the community that get some kind of training and really work among their neighbors to spread information about medicine, about seeing the doctor, all these kinds of things. And so they distribute the books with some kind of advice about how kids could use the books and families could use the books. And they're bilingual, so the parents could read to the kids if they're younger than reading age in either language. And the kids can read them themselves, but they're very interesting. Like one is about skateboarding, another one's about playing soccer, another one is a girl, trying to fit into her pretty dress. Yeah, they're, kid stuff, but they can be very funny, but have a message that's important. And we did paperbacks, and on the back cover of the paperback, in Spanish and English, are instructions to families about the issue that's conveyed in the book and how to deal with it in their family. We were able to maintain that program for a number of years. Right now, we're in a hiatus because we don't have much. Our main sponsors they don't do it forever, so we're looking around for some continued funding. But those books turned out to be in high demand. So what we did was we turned around and published them as our regular Piñata bilingual children's picture books. And they continued to do well, even though that they had this very directed message about health and, even community gardening and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, I would think those subjects are of interest, I think, pretty broadly. So I think it doesn't surprise me that you have done well with them in stores. I think that makes sense. So tell me, I guess, just sort of How do you see the future? What is it going to be for you, for the press and for you personally? At some point, you know, do you have a plan for succession? How's that going to work?
Yeah. Well, again, we had consultants in, and they helped us set up our administrative structure. And I kind of work like a CEO. And our different, we have four different managers of the different departments of Arte Público: recovery, marketing, editorial, and financial. And they pretty much run the show, and they can continue to do that with or without me. So the plan is they will continue to do that, and either one of them will step up to be a director, probably the one that has academic standing here at the university and is tenured, and that's the way it should continue. Yes, I'm getting long in the tooth, but I don't see retirement with in the next few years. It's not in the cards unless something happens.
Well, that's good. I don't think, you know, it's, I don't think anybody necessarily feels like they should, you know, that it's, you don't need to quit unless you really feel like you've had enough and you want to do something different. So, it sounds like you're fine doing what you're doing. So let me ask you, is there any kind of project or endeavor that you dream about doing with the press that you have not done heretofore, or is everything so far, you know, are you satisfied, or is there anything left that you still want to do?
Yes, there is. We have some, you know, projects on the back burner that, you know, like, we don't want to talk a lot about them, but it involves creating a large space online where we could provide all kinds of information and material, and including converting a lot of the stuff that we have in the recovery project and making it immediately accessible to get it into the hands of students, especially in places like Texas and Arizona, where the official school systems do not allow our material in. I mean, last year, in Arizona alone, they went into the classrooms and took books that we published out of the hands of kids in their anti-ethnic, anti-immigrant fervor. So we're developing ways of getting around those kinds of blockades and prejudicial, racist barriers that they've constructed to getting our books and our thought and our art out into the community and out into kids' hands and families and so on and so forth.
Well, that's good. So we have more to watch out for from Arte Público.
I hope so.
Well, Nicholas, thank you so much for talking to me about the press and the magazine and everything you've done, which I think is really important work. And I think, you know, you should be proud of everything you've accomplished.
Thanks, David. It's great talking to you, and I really appreciate your interest in this.
Thanks. So this has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I've been talking to Nicholas Caneos about Arte Público Press, which is located at the University of Houston in Houston, Texas. And thank you very much.